Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to You're On Mute, a new podcast series conceived by BBI, the UK's first Black Business Institute, boosting prospects for underprivileged Black entrepreneurs by promoting equivalent access to funding structures and essential business networks. I'm your host, Lord Michael Hastings, and over the next 16 weeks, me and my fellow hosts will be interviewing an incredible lineup of leaders, icons, and changemakers to ascertain how they balance the importance of commercial performance versus societal impact. The killing of George Floyd and the COVID-19 pandemic has highlighted racial disparity has disproportionately affected the globe's Black communities, and here, we discuss the importance of balancing both commercial performance and societal impact. And as we all know, with great power comes huge responsibility. And this series looks at how those in positions of influence can use their status as a force for good. Our time together is broken down into three sections, each one punctuated by the guest's favorite piece of music, signaling different stages of their life. And joining me today is Jason Tarry, CEO of Tesco's UK, and Ireland. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you very much, Michael. Very nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So take us into your first track that sits in your heart. Soft Cell, Say Hello, Wave Goodbye.
Yeah, it's not a particularly obvious piece, actually, but when I grew up in a small village in Kent, we looked forward every Monday night to our youth club evening at the local town hall, and there was a disco area. And this was in that, showing my age now, I was a young teenager, and this was in the early 80s. And there was quite an emergence of lots of different musical styles in the 80s that I think made it a really interesting time. And I particularly was taken with the sort of new romantics. And at the forefront of that were bands such as Human League, Depeche Mode, and first and foremost, I think, Soft Cell. And everybody knows and sings along to Tainted Love. But actually, my very favourite track from their seminal album, Nonstop Erotic Cabaret, is Say Hello, Wave Goodbye.
Very beautiful. Those must have been lovely memories of your childhood. What did you enjoy when you were young?
I would say a fairly idyllic childhood. So I came from a very modest background. Both my parents worked, my father worked for the local council at the fire brigade. Fitting out fire engines, literally almost opposite our house. And my mother she's full-time looking after my sister and I, but actually also worked seasonally in the sort of quite a rural area, a lot of fruit growing. So she helped out in the fields in the summer. So many of my summers were spent playing in the dirt with other children at that particular point. We didn't have much, but had unbelievable love from my parents all the way through my childhood. And yeah, there wasn't a lot around us, but you know, we amused ourselves and did all sorts of things around and about the community. And I had a really sheltered but very enjoyable childhood.
Well, you had a lot in having the great love of your family, and I know you mentioned that you've had a number of significant hero type role models. American, I know, Barry Sheen, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, but of course your father. Was there anyone in the UK that was a hero to you?
No, well, I think you mentioned a few there, and of course, like many sons, I very much looked up to my father. You know, he's a very strong figure in our household, and many of the interests that he had, I ended up sort of following. So motorcycling was a big thing of his, and that's why I would probably point to my biggest hero when I was growing up was the motorcyclist Barry Sheen, who was from Southeast London, so not too far away from me in Kent, and obviously we had there's a very famous racing track called Brands Hatch that was about half an hour drive from our house, and you know, we had a kind of annual pilgrimage there at Easter for the races, the transatlantic races, the British against the Americans, and Barry Sheen was my hero, and I was lucky once to meet him when I was a young 10 or 11 years old and get his autograph. And then the other things that my father handed down to me, so my sort of love of fishing, so which I do with one of my sons, is very keen as well. So some rural pursuits, but also just some things that that he loved and I ended up enjoying as well. And that's why Barry Sheen was my hero. But you're right, I used to watch a lot of cowboy films, and I loved John Wayne and I loved Clint Eastwood. I just thought they were powerful, charismatic, doing good over evil and triumphing against adversity. It sort of really appealed to me somehow.
That's a theme of your life, which is actually really, really, really remarkable and beautiful. Higher education is what kind of kicked you up into the next level of your life. What did you study? Yeah. Where did you go?
Yeah, no, so I went to a very small rural primary school. There's only 80 of us there. In the final year, there was only 10 of us. So it felt very personal, very individual. Everybody knew everyone. The teachers knew you. After that, I ended up going to a big comprehensive school on the edge of Maidstone, which was a bit more of a challenge. You know, I went from being a big fish in a small pond to really being, a small fish in a big pond, and suddenly having to travel on a school bus with lots of people I didn't know. And it was quite daunting. But I was lucky enough after a couple of years to be just about selected to go to Maidstone Grammar School. So Kent has always been conservatively held and has retained its selective grammar schools. And at that time, it wasn't about an 11 plus exam. It was about sort of continuous assessment. And basically, I was told at 13 that I was borderline and I could go if I wanted to, but I might struggle. And there was this sort of big debate in the household. My mother very much wanted the best for me and said I should go for it. And my father said, look, we don't go to the grammar school. It's not what we do. You know, we're a working class family. And but I went. I was what you would call bang average. So I was average at everything, nothing good at anything. But actually, I tell you what, there's a real privilege of being in a school where you are selected on your ability. So even if you don't stand out in any way, shape, or form, the very fact that you're already there breeds in you a sense of confidence and also surrounds you with people who have a certain performance and intellect standard, which that really sort of helps. And I think that was a privilege. After that, and I really enjoyed it. It was a boys' school, but we used to get the bus in, a public bus into town, which took about an hour. And the girls from the girls' school got on it as well. So it's fabulously sociable on the bus on the way to school. You should really look forward to the bus there and the bus back home. They were the highlights of the day. And often, of course, you'd find that you might miss the odd lesson at the start or end of day in order to meet the girls from the school with your best friend. So I absolutely loved it and didn't really want to leave, enjoyed it immensely, made some lifelong friends. I was going to go to work because, again, nobody in my family, either on my mother or my father's side, had ever been onto further education, university, or even a college. And it wasn't really the done thing. But my best friend, Graham, was going to Sheffield University, and I had that awful, halfway through my final year, had that awful fear of missing out, FOMO. So I sort of had a look round, decided I wanted to do something a bit more vocational that might lead to work, found a place that was only 50 miles away from where he was in Sheffield, and thought, great, I can go there and see him every weekend or something, which was Stoke-on-Trent. I went to North Staffs Polytechnic, which is now Staffordshire University. And that's probably that kind of fear of missing out decision was probably the best one I made in my life. Suddenly going from a small rural community in Kent to a large, well, a city in the Midlands with all of its differences and diversity thrown into a sort of melting pot of of people from all walks of life and all parts of the country. And we were there for 4 years with two six-month placements. And again, I really didn't want to leave. I loved every moment of it, made lifelong friends, and almost everything since then has not quite measured up to those brilliant days where every day is an adventure. You learn something new and you're on your own with a level of freedom that you never would have really expected. So yeah, I in the end, I knuckled down in the final year and managed to get a half decent degree. So yeah, really, I had a really good time. When I really loved education. I really loved the whole, not so much, I didn't enjoy working, doing homework, or I didn't really enjoy the lessons that much. I just really enjoyed being there with everyone and the social side of it. And that's a very long answer to quite a short question. Sorry, Michael.
And is
got
that
carried away? You can tell how I feel about it. Yeah,
I can tell it's really deep into your positive psyche. Yeah. Your well-being is filled up by it. It's wonderful. Yeah. And obviously you met people of so many different colors and cultures for the first time in some cases.
Well, you know, absolutely. I mean, when I was growing up in the small village, there was basically one family that wasn't white British. That was a Asian family who ran the local restaurant, and sort of seen with a little bit of kind of slight fear and slight, trepidation, really. People just sort of kept themselves themselves, and we kept out of their way, and that's a British village in Kent in the 1980s. When I went to Stoke-on-Trent, of course, it was completely different. I met the very first a child of a broken home. I've never come across that before. I ended up on a course with colleagues from, South Asia, East Asia, black colleagues, and people that clearly were also gay as well. So, I know it sounds ridiculous in this day and age, but I'd never come across that before, let alone the fact, there were Scottish people there, Irish people, people from the north, people from the south, people from everywhere. So it was a real eye opener for me, and actually very helpful in terms of broadening my horizons, opening up the possibilities of the world, and exposing me to cultures and backgrounds and people that I probably wouldn't have done if I'd stayed where I was.
So, did you say it was? Would you say it was formative to helping you think about the whole inclusion, diversity, equity agenda?
I mean, since you've just asked the question, I guess it must have been. I think I think one of the things it did give me that, very, very quickly appealed to me was wanting to understand experience and be curious about other cultures and other lives and other ways of living. And for example, as soon as I left university, rather than go to work, I went traveling because I wanted to see the world. I wanted to, and I didn't want to just visit, right? So I went away for a year, but I had a work visa for Australia. I worked, dare I say, illegally in America because I didn't have a green card. But what I found was, what I enjoyed most is where I stayed somewhere and I went to work and I met people from, from that country or from that region in the country and saw them up close and personal during their everyday lives, rather than, travel around with a backpack visiting, monuments and go sightseeing and that sort of thing, which is wonderful, right? But it doesn't really get you into where you are. And particularly, really, one of the other things, I really got exposed to, I was in Sydney, and what was really fascinating for me was working in a cosmetics factory and seeing the communities of Indigenous Australian and also actually New Zealand, communities of New Zealand, particularly New Zealand Maori, who basically were doing a lot of the jobs that, these sort of highly manual jobs, factory-based jobs. And again, sort of a complete eye opener versus wandering around Sydney Opera House or going to Ayers Rock or something. So, I guess you're right. Thinking out loud and answering the question out loud, I think it probably did give me a taste for wanting, being curious and wanting to see how, see, know, experience other cultures.
And talking of that curiosity, I think, if I'm right, that while you were in Australia, you saw an advert to work for Tesco's.
Well, I just got back. I tell you what happened. It's one of those things where I loved my time there, and I thought, I don't really, I have my parents and my sister at home, but I don't have any other ties. Wouldn't it be wonderful to go and live in Australia? And I looked into it, and the only way that I could do that and work was if I had a professional qualification or trade, or relatives already residing in Australia who would sponsor me. I didn't have relatives. I did business studies at Staffs University, and there was a module in finance. Now, finance wasn't my strength. In fact, I failed my equivalent of maths GCSE the first time round. So not my strength at all. But I could see that it was the easiest step towards a professional qualification by studying to be an accountant. And so the moment I got back to the UK, I thought, well, how am I going to find a way to get? And I was looking around for jobs, and I saw Tesco were advertising, and obviously knew who Tesco were, which is unusual. When you come out of university looking at jobs, you're trying to sort of, you have no idea. You see these company names, you've got no idea what they do. So, and I knew what Tesco did, so that was good. And I looked at, and it was a good training package, and it was a company car. And I looked at where they were, and they were based sort of on the edge of North London, in Cheshunt, and I'm a big Arsenal fan, so I thought, oh good, I can live in North London, go and see Arsenal's home matches every other week, and get qualified with Tesco, and then go off to Australia. So, which is why I got rejected first time, and they rang me back the next week and said, actually, we've got another job now, it hasn't got a company car, but everything else is the same, would you like to join? I said, yeah, okay. So I joined Tesco 31 years ago as a graduate trainee in finance. And clearly, as you know, when you're young, things change. You know, you get to experience and see different things. And I didn't go back to Australia, and I didn't emigrate. I did pass my finance exams, but I'm still with Tesco 31 years later. So, yeah, that's what happened.
That's beautiful. That's a wonderful way to come round to the journey that you've been on. Let's go into your second piece of music, Stone Roses, yeah. Fool's Gold. Now, what's the lyric there?
Well, here you go. So it's not so much the lyrics; it's the fact that my best friends, I sort of fell in with a group at university who were from Manchester. Two of my very best friends went to school together in South Manchester, and towards the end of my time at Staffs Poly, there's always been a very strong music scene in Manchester, but it really emerged on a national scale, and a number of bands emerged where Manchester, I think it ended up being called Madchester, and it was all based on this sort of live music, dance phenomenon, Hacienda and so on. And Stone Roses is one of those key bands that emerged at that time. And so we used to listen to it quite a lot. And the year after we left uni, we went on one of those package holidays to Lloret de Mar in Spain. And I remember before we were going out to, for the evening, we put on the Stone Roses and sort of gee ourselves up, and Fool's Gold was out, one of our favorites. So there you go. In your 20s, kind of making your way in life.
How did the music make you feel? Was it like...
It's music that really gets you going. You know, you kind of feel the rhythm, you speed up slightly, and it imbues you with energy. So, and confidence. Or maybe that was the drinking that was going alongside listening to it before we go out. Could have been a bit of both.
Yeah. You're very real, as you're right. Just let's go back to your first memories of Tesco's and your initial bosses. You had initial bosses were female bosses, and how was that for you?
So you're right. I think three out of the first, or well, maybe four out of the first five leaders that I worked for in Tesco were female leaders, and which I think was quite unusual actually at the time. Quite unusual per se, but actually I think I was quite lucky in terms of the people that I work for. And I really enjoyed it. You know, I had a good relationship with my bosses. They were very encouraging of me. I wanted to please them. I wanted to do a good job for them, and sort of that worked both ways, really. But it is fair to say, you know, back in those days, the culture was generally more male, more macho. It's a fairly, you know, it's as you know, I mean, retail is fast moving, competitive, and you know, you needed to be on it in terms of trying to make sure you're moving the whole thing forward. So I guess it was unusual that I ended up with, you know, the two Marys, Alison and Sandra, as being my bosses at that time. But, you know, it was, I found it easier. I could be more relaxed than with male bosses that I had, where it was much more, much less able to have a proper open conversation, much less able to talk about what was really going on, much less able to lose faith in any conversation, let alone any particular initiative, which I suppose on reflection isn't really surprising, but that's how it was.
And you quickly, you're on a graduate accelerator scheme. It's clear that Tesco saw you as great talent and they wanted to develop you and wanted to give you lots of opportunities because, I mean, you made it well in fuel and you could make it elsewhere. So you went on to do internationally connected roles.
Yes. I think if I sort of look back to how I was considered, it's true. I think I was seen as high potential, but also slightly different to many of my peers and colleagues who had sort of very traditionally come through a one function and done well in all of that and moved forward. And also sort of good track records of performance. I think I was seen as slightly different. You know, I come from finance. I come from a sort of a service support background. So I had quite a different outlook on working with people, much less the center of the decision-making, more around the how do I sort of engage with people to help make the right decision, rather than sort of focus on using sort of the power of the role. I used data a lot because of my finance to try and support my arguments to do it that way, which was quite different at the time. And also, I think because I'd done different things and that curiosity that I developed through university and particularly when I was traveling, you know, I was up for things. So people saw me as being adaptable, flexible, and, you know, happy to try different things. And on that basis, and could turn my hand to them. On that basis, I was asked to sort of work on this sort of brand new team where we were looking at supporting our international businesses that we were developing and helping support them in capability development and looking at opportunities to work more effectively across the countries. Now, of course, that was fantastic because it's like an internal consultant role. And, you know, so I was going out to these wonderful places, Thailand, South Korea, which is quite the most different place I'd ever been to. It's different to anywhere you'd ever been. Central Europe, you know, were not communists, were coming into mainland Europe. Those markets were opening up in a way we'd not seen before. So working in those, going to see those countries, those cultures, working with lots of local people that we'd hired or acquired, but actually you had low knowledge of modern retailing and helping build their capability to do that. But in order to do that, trying to understand again the culture, the backgrounds, the how do you connect with someone well in Poland or Thailand or Malaysia or South Korea. So I really enjoyed that, learned a lot being able to do that. And I actually was asked to sort of set up our sourcing, sorry, it was already set up, take over our sourcing operation in the Far East, where we were sourcing a lot of products from China and South Asia and actually close to the home as well, which again gave me another whole kind of world of opportunity to explore new cultures and and people from different backgrounds. So it was brilliant, really good, fantastic.
What would you say, given what you said about connecting with people and about working across borders and boundaries and countries and languages, what was the germ of the bright idea you learned from all of that? How did you make these connections work?
I actually think at the heart of it all, we're individual human beings. And if you can just work on the person in front of you, not where they're from, what language they are, what color they are, whatever. It's just you're making a connection on a human level with another human being is the basis of everything, in my opinion. And actually, underneath a lot of the differences in background, culture, and all the other things, there appear to be some innate human needs that sociability, that connection, that ability to be able to laugh, that ability to be able to connect on things like family or on, you know, it's quite interesting. And I think, I work on the basis that if you can find common ground, if you can put yourself in other people's shoes and understand where they're coming from and try and find what you have in common and what the opportunities are, there's many more things to do. Yeah, we're trying to do the same thing. Let's look for what those opportunities are rather than focus on the differences. I think makes a big difference, really. And that seems to work for me through my career.
And Tesco's has obviously grew enormously, and you initiated Club Card. Well, Club Card was initiated by Tesco's. Yeah. Tesco's finest.
I wish I had. Yeah.
The business did.
I was around.
Business. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I was around at that time. Yeah.
But then there was the hiccup of the US. What do you feel about that?
No, look, I think we had this sort of. So in 31 years, I've kind of seen it all, really. So, you know, when I first joined, we were distant number two to Jay Sainsbury, and we were close to being overtaken by Safeway, which no longer exists anymore. It's part of, you know, it was taken over by Morrison. So we weren't in a particularly great shape at that time. But I saw under a sort of new strategy under Lord McLaurin, you know, about how we were going to expand out-of-town superstores, some real change in our fortunes. And then that was built on incredibly by Sir Terry Leahy, who really took on the customer agenda in an amazing way, where there was Club Card and Finest and Express and online. All those things happened under Terry's tenure. And in 1995, we overtook Sainsbury to be number one, and that sort of gave us great momentum, and we never looked back. And I think the 10 years after that were the golden years. Almost anything we did, everything we touched went well, and we were the darlings of the press, of the customers, and that sort of thing. All of that happened, and I think, you know, we felt like we could turn our hands to anything, that our brand could stretch to anything, and I'm not saying we didn't go through the usual rigor that we would have done during those sort of 10 years, but some of the things that have worked for us suddenly stopped working for us, and things became more difficult. And we probably at that point started to look more internally rather than focus on the customer. And that's when it started to go wrong, really. And I think in any business at any time, you have to keep focused on your customer. The customer is definitely king. I know it's a cliche, but it's absolutely true. And you only as good as the last time that they engage with you. And therefore, how do you keep focused on being good at what you do every day, focused on customers, and making sure that you look after your assets to deliver for customers? And of course, our number one asset, and I don't like to call them that because it's not very personal, but our number one assets are our colleagues. You know, 290,000 of them here in the UK, you know, with the biggest private sector employer. Our business is about people. It's people serving people, even in this digital world. Therefore, I think that's incredibly important. So, and we probably just, you know, kind of got distracted away from that as we were trying to sort out some of the things that hadn't gone as well as had done previously. We went into the US, spent a lot of money going into it, and then I think Philip Clark, who took over from Terry Leahy, took us out of it again. And then And then Dave Lewis after that sort of got us out of some of the other markets that we were in, just to make sure, you know, because we had to, because of the situation we found ourselves in financially, in order to sort of affect our turnaround. Mm.
So now to your third piece of music, and this is one that you know how to say better than I know how to say. So your third piece of music is...
Oh, yeah. So at the moment, I'm listening to Led Zeppelin a lot, which sounds a bit odd because, you know, they're around in the sort of 60s and 70s. But I think they're just such an amazing, you know, they change the face of music. They're one of those bands that change the face of music. And the more you listen to them, the better they get. And right now I'm listening to the third album, Led Zeppelin 3, and my favourite track in it, I might not even pronounce it correctly. It's the name of the farmhouse they recorded the album in. It's Bronior Stomp is what it's called. And the reason I love it is because it's got a real energy to it. I'm spending a lot of time, through lockdown, I spent a lot of time walking, out and about, taking my daily exercise. And I found myself walking a lot more than I ever have. And this is a piece of music I listen to because it helps me to... It kind of just goes where you walk faster, you feel better, and it gives energy. So I like music that gives me energy, and that particular track does at the moment. I'll play it to death. So I end up playing things to death and then sort of moving on to the next thing. So that's the one I'm listening to at the moment.
Well, one thing you're obviously not going to move on from is your commitment to ESG, environmental, social, and governance procedures. Just tell us about how important that is to Tesco. What does it actually mean in practice?
Yeah, so I think, look, I'm glad we're having this conversation now, because two or three weeks ago at our interim update to financial update to the city, we announced that we revised our core purpose. So our core purpose was to serve our shoppers a little better every day. And we've now evolved it to be to serve our customers, communities, and planet a little better every day. So effectively, we're doing what our customers and our colleagues expect us to, which is to be a responsible business in today's society, not just in service of our customers and our shareholders, but also the communities in which we live, work, and serve, and the planet that, you know, serves us. So therefore, we need to, you know, us along with every other business, individual, government, society needs to step forward to face into what we know to be the biggest crisis of our times. You know, I know right now we're sat here with, you know, COVID still with us, supply chain challenges, Brexit, all of those things are immediate crises. But actually, the biggest immediate crisis is the one of our planet and the climate within it. So we're putting it out there. Therefore, we have a real obligation to deliver against that. And we've always had a strong agenda in that space anyway. And we're moving it forward as we do. And I could talk a lot about the planet now. You know, commitment to net zero by 2035. The fact that we're rolling out more electric charging points than anybody else across the country to 2,400. The fact that we've taken our food waste down by 42% since our baseline. The fact that, you know, 100% of our energy in all of our business here in the UK is from renewable sources, not just certificated. So there's lots that we're doing in that space. I think the one the element of the agenda that's really been important to me personally has been the one around inclusivity and diversity. And, you know, when you are responsible for over 290,000 colleagues, when those colleagues, as I've said, come, you know, we are present in every community in the UK, and we have colleagues that live and work in every community in the UK. In order for us to do a brilliant job for them, for our customers and our colleagues, we have to make sure that we're an inclusive business in order to be able to understand and make the decisions that we need to make in that way. So the last couple of years, we've really sort of stepped up our agenda with exec sponsorship, with mentor-mentee program, with, you know, all the things that you would expect Michael, that we would say we would have the processes in place around talent spotting, recruitment, development, listening, and it's starting to bear fruit in a way that I'm really pleased about. But one of the things that I'm actually the exec sponsor for race and ethnicity for Tesco. The story that I've been able to tell to you is this sort of working class boy made good, defying the odds. What I've learned over the last couple of years is that I've been a bit deluded in that regard. Yes, it's an achievement, but actually I've had many of the cards stacked in my favour, even though it hadn't felt like that on the way through. And that really came home to me through the mentorship program that we had in place. This is how we met. I ended up being matched with a young man from Dulwich in South London, Samuel, of Nigerian heritage, and getting to know him on a very personal level and understanding what it takes, what it's like to be a young Black adult in our society, particularly coming from a tough part of the capital, and what you have to do in order to be able to get yourself in a place that you can find a pathway out, particularly through the sort of pathway that I've been able to enjoy through business, is simply incredible. And whilst I can never live that experience, the insight and the candor and the openness that Samuel, and in fact some of his friends and some of the other mentees have shared with me, have made me realize how you know, we live in this our society, which is systemically racist, and that's hundreds of years embedded. And you know, in order to make a difference, we have to think about it. I have to think about it every day. I have to reach into our organization and reach into our business every day, and I have to literally, you know, metaphorically pull people through or make a difference in that very interventionist way, because I'm fighting a system that has been built over hundreds of years. And I make no apology for that internally either. You know, I think it's, in order to make a difference, you absolutely have to do that. And on the one hand, it's been incredibly sobering and humbling to be able to learn from Samuel. It's also been incredibly frustrating, because you think, you know, all the progress you want to make, you can't make as quickly as you want to make. It's almost a bit like my role as exec sponsor here is, you know, it's more than a sponsorship for me. This is now part of my role description, alongside, you know, running the UK and Ireland business, delivering the P&L, all the governance around all that. I actually see it as key part of my job to make sure we move this forward. We've made some really good recent appointments to help, you know, to help sort of demonstrate to the business that we're serious about this, and that, you know, there are people that, one of the big bits of feedback I get is it's not enough people around here that look like me or sound like me, or, you know, I can relate to, and doing more of that is what we've been focused on. It's a massive opportunity and really important for us as a business and a leading business that everybody has an experience of and has a view about, and being the, you know, the biggest employer outside of the government in the country.
I know that you are a fantastic mentor to Samuel, and he speaks so highly of you, the great insights you've brought to him. Your heart is clearly wide open, and you've got the executive responsibility in the business. And at the moment, you don't have any Black executive directors. How do you think you can correct and advance that? When you've got Asian directors, that's a good thing. How can you advance the Black executive roles?
Well, I think it's become a bit of a lightning rod for me, because I actually think the need, if we can start to create a pipeline of people into senior roles from our Black colleague community, that will actually mean that we'll make a bigger difference overall, because I feel as though that community is more behind any other community in our business. You know, when I'm looking at minority and ethnic groups, and therefore actually our focus, my focus has not been, of course it is, there's an overall focus to make sure we get people through the business into senior roles that then mean that other people join us, or or can believe that they can make a career and move through the business in Tesco. But actually, the very positive interventions around Black colleagues. We've recently appointed our first Black director in our store network, the first one ever. Now, Freddie, it's almost a year after I wanted it to happen, but that is because we're determined to make sure that now he's appointed, he's best equipped to be able to succeed. This is not about appointing people because of their skin color. It's actually about developing people to be ready for bigger and bigger jobs in Tesco so they can succeed and become great contributors to our business and also inspirational to other people that look like them within our business. And I think that's really important to us. So I'm absolutely delighted we've got Freddie into that position. It's actually, in one sense, it's a big step for us. In the other sense, it's a small step for us because now we need to have people who sit on our, you know, operating boards and on our executive committee who are Black. And that's the next target. And by the way, there are a number of other people that are coming through that, and Freddie soon won't be alone. I'm absolutely convinced of that. But it's I don't want to go out and hire someone just to sort of tick a box. What I'm absolutely keen to do, going back to this point around, this is a systemic problem that we face, and therefore, how do we create something that is sustained? How do we create solutions that are sustainable by making sure that we have people who are qualified, developed, experienced enough to succeed and continue to succeed in our business on a, you know, human being level, I think is incredibly important for us.
Progress. And clearly you are absolutely rigidly committed to it. It's in your DNA. So just lastly, we ask all of our guests if they make a pledge for the future. It can be about absolutely anything. It could be very personal, very organizational, very national. What would you, in the forefront of your mind, like to pledge to commit to?
In any sense at all, Michael, or is it?
In
is
any it sense at all, anything of any nature.
My desire, ambition, pledge, if you like, is to ensure that I end up with a Black colleague alongside me, helping me run the UK on our UK operating board. And when I achieve that, I'll be the happiest man in Tesco.
Jason, thank you. You really are quite remarkable and so open and warm and honest. Thank you so much for joining us today. Sadly, we've got to wrap it up at that point. I know this episode is going to stick with us for a very long time. Please join us next time on BBI's You're on Mute, where we hear from another icon, a business leader, a famous personality. Until then, please subscribe, review, leave your feedback wherever you get your podcast from. If you're a leader and would like to share your journey and opinions on social justice and a fairer society, please contact us at info@blackbusinessinstitute.com. Until the next time, goodbye and thank you for being with us.